Chapter 17. Ordinaire, trying to go down as orthodox port, and very meager ordinaire to Hopkins historical works, to Pumpkins poetry, ordinaire again thin, feeble, overrated, and so down the whole list. And when we have done discussing our men friends, have we not all the women? Do these not advance absurd pretensions? Do these never give themselves airs? With feeble brains, don't they often set up dubious priest forts? Don't they pretend to be women of fashion, and cut their betters? Don't they try, and pass off their ordinary-looking girls as beauties of the first order? Every man in his circle knows women who give themselves airs, and to whom we can apply the port wine simile. Come, my friends, here is enough of ordinaire and port for today. My bottle has run out. Will anybody have any more? Let us go upstairs, and get a cup of tea from the ladies. Ogres. I dare say the reader has remarked that the upright and independent vowel, which stands in the vowel list between E and O, has formed the subject of the main part of these essays. How does that vowel feel this morning? Fresh, good-humored, and lively? The roundabout lines, which fall from this pen, are correspondingly brisk and cheerful. Has anything, on the contrary, disagreed with the vowel? Has its rest been disturbed, or was yesterday's dinner too good, or yesterday's wine not good enough? Under such circumstances, a darkling, misanthropic tinge, no doubt, is cast upon the paper. The jokes, if attempted, are elaborate and dreary. The bitter temper breaks out. That sneering manner is adopted, which you know, and which exhibits itself so, especially when the writer is speaking about women. A moody carelessness comes over him. He sees no good in anybody or thing, and treats gentlemen, ladies, history, and things in general, with a light gloomy flippancy. Agreed. When the vowel in question is in that mood, if you like airy gaiety and tender gushing benevolence, if you want to be satisfied with yourself and the rest of your fellow beings, I recommend you, my dear creature, to go to some other shop in Cornhill, or turn to some other article. There are moods in the mind of the vowel of which we are speaking, when it is ill-conditioned and captious. Who always keeps good health and good humor? Do not philosophers grumble? Are not sages sometimes out of temper? And do not angel women go off in tantrums? Today my mood is dark. I scowl as I dip my pen in the inkstand. Here is the day come round for everything here is done with the utmost regularity. Intellectual labor, 16 hours. Meals, 32 minutes. Exercise, 148 minutes. Conversation with the family, chiefly literary, and about the housekeeping, 1 hour and 4 minutes. Sleep, 3 hours and 15 minutes. At the end of the month, when the magazine is complete, I take 8 minutes more, and the rest for the toilet and the world. Well, I say, the roundabout paper day being come, and the subject long since settled in my mind, an excellent subject, a most telling, lively, and popular subject, I go to breakfast determined to finish that meal in 9 3 4 minutes, as usual, and then retire to my desk and work, when oh, provoking! Here in the paper is the very subject treated, on which I was going to write. Yesterday another paper which I saw treated it and of course, as I need not tell you, spoiled it. Last Saturday, another paper had an article on the subject. Perhaps you may guess what it was, but I won't tell you. Only this is true, my favorite subject, which was about to make the best paper we have had for a long time. My bird, my game that I was going to shoot and serve up with such a delicate sauce, has been found by other sportsmen. And pop, 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 a half dozen of guns have banged at it, mangled it, and brought it down. And can't you take some other text, say you? All this is mighty well. But if you have set your heart on a certain dish for dinner, be it cold-boiled veal, or what you will, and they bring you turtle and venison, don't you feel disappointed? During your walk you have been making up your mind that that cold meat, with moderation and a pickle, will be a very sufficient dinner. You have accustomed your thoughts to it, and here, in place of it, is a turkey, surrounded by coarse sausages, or a reeking pigeon pie or a fulsome roast pig. I have known many a good and kind man made furiously angry by such a contretemps. I have known him lose his temper, call his wife and servants names, and a whole household made miserable. If, then, as is notoriously the case, it is too dangerous to balk a man about his dinner, how much more about his article? I came to my meal with an ogre-like appetite and gusto. Fee, faw, fum. Wife, where is that tender little princekin? Have you trussed him, and did you stuff him nicely, and have you taken care to baste him and do him, not too brown, as I told you? Quick! I am hungry. I begin to whet my knife, to roll my eyes about, and roar and clap my huge chest like a gorilla, and then my poor Agrina has to tell me that the little princes have all run away, whilst she was in the kitchen, making the paste to bake them in. I pause in the description. I won't condescend to report the bad language, which you know must ensue, when an ogre, whose mind is ill-regulated, and whose habits of self-indulgence are notorious, finds himself disappointed of his pretty hopes. What treatment of his wife, what abuse and brutal behavior to his children, who, though ogrelons, are children. My dears, you may fancy, and need not ask my delicate pen to describe, the language and behavior of a vulgar, coarse, greedy, large man with an immense mouth and teeth, which are too frequently employed in the gobbling and crunching of raw man's meat. And in this circuitous way you see I have reached my present subject, which is, ogres. You fancy they are dead, or only fictitious characters, mythical representatives of strength, cruelty, stupidity, and lust for blood. Though they had seven-leagued boots, you remember all sorts of little whipping, snapping Tom Thumbs used to elude and outrun them. They were so stupid that they gave in to the most shallow ambuscades and artifices. Witness that well-known ogre, who, because Jack cut open hasty pudding, instantly ripped open his own stupid waistcoat and interior. They were cruel, brutal, disgusting, with their sharpened teeth, immense knives, and roaring voices, but they always ended by being overcome by little Tom Thumbkins, or some other smart little champion. Yes, they were conquered in the end, there is no doubt. They plunged headlong and uttering the most frightful bad language into some pit, where Jack came with his smart couteau de chasse, and whipped their brutal heads off. They would be going to devour maidens. But ever when it seemed their need was at the sorest, a knight, in armor bright, came riding through the forest. And down, after a combat, would go the brutal persecutor, with a lance through his midriff. Yes, I say, this is very true and well. But you remember that round the ogre's cave the ground was covered, for hundreds and hundreds of yards, with the bones of the victims whom he had lured into the castle. Many knights and maids came to him, and perished under his knife and teeth. Were dragons the same as ogres? Monsters dwelling in caverns, whence they rushed, attired in plate armor, wielding pikes and torches, and destroying stray passengers who passed by their lair? Monsters, brutes, rapacious tyrants, ruffians, as they were, doubtless they ended by being overcome. But, before they were destroyed, they did a deal of mischief. The bones round their caves were countless. They had sent many brave souls to Hades, before their own fled, howling out of their rascal carcasses, to the same place of gloom. There is no greater mistake than to suppose that fairies, champions, distressed damsels, and by consequence ogres, have ceased to exist. It may not be ogreable to them, pardon the horrible pleasantry, but as I am writing in the solitude of my chamber, I am grinding my teeth, yelling, roaring, and cursing, brandishing my scissors and paper cutter, and as it were, have become an ogre. I say there is no greater mistake than to suppose that ogres have ceased to exist. We all know ogres. Their caverns are round us, and about us. There are the castles of several ogres within a mile of the spot where I write. I think some of them suspect I am an ogre myself. I am not. But I know they are. I visit them. I don't mean to say that they take a cold roast prince out of the cupboard and have a cannibal feast before me. But I see the bones lying about the roads to their houses and in the areas and gardens. Politeness, of course, prevents me from making any remarks, but I know them well enough. One of the ways to know them is to watch the scared looks of the ogre's wives and children. They lead an awful life. They are present at dreadful cruelties. In their excesses, those ogres will stab about and kill not only strangers who happen to call in and ask a night's lodging, but they will outrage, murder, and chop up their own kin. We all know ogres, I say, and have been in their dens often. It is not necessary that ogres who ask you to dine should offer their guests the peculiar dish which they like. They cannot always get a Tom Thumb family. They eat mutton and beef too, and I dare say even go out to tea and invite you to drink it. But I tell you there are numbers of them going about in the world. And now you have my word for it, and this little hint, it is quite curious what an interest society may be made to have for you by your determining to find out the ogres you meet there. What does the man mean? Says Mrs. Downright, to whom a joke is a very grave thing. I mean, madam, that in the company assembled in your genteel drawing room, who bow here and there and smirk in white neckcloths, you receive men who elbow through life successfully enough, but who are ogres in private. Men wicked, false, rapacious, flattering, cruel hectors at home, smiling courtiers abroad, causing wives, children, servants, parents, to tremble before them, and smiling and bowing as they bid strangers welcome into their castles. I say, there are men who have crunched the bones of victim after victim, in whose closets lie skeletons picked frightfully clean. When these ogres come out into the world, you don't suppose they show their knives and their great teeth. A neat simple white neckcloth, a merry rather obsequious manner, a cadaverous look, perhaps, now and again, and a rather dreadful grin, but I know ogres very considerably respected. And when you hint to such and such a man, my dear sir, Mr. Sharpus, whom you appear to like, is, I assure you, a most dreadful cannibal, the gentleman cries, oh, sa, nonsense. Dare say not so black as he is painted. Dare say not worse than his neighbors. We condone everything in this country: private treason, falsehood, flattery, cruelty at home, roguery, and double dealing. What? Do you mean to say in your acquaintance you don't know ogres guilty of countless crimes of fraud and force, and that knowing them, you don't shake hands with them, dine with them at your table, and meet them at their own? Depend upon it, in the time when there were real live ogres in real caverns or castles, gobbling up real knights and virgins, when they went into the world the neighboring market town, let us say, or Earl's Castle, though their nature and reputation were pretty well known, their notorious foibles were never alluded to. You would say, what, Blunderbur, my boy? How do you do? How well and fresh you look! What's the receipt you have for keeping so young and rosy? And your wife would softly ask after Mrs. Blunderbur and the dear children. Or it would be, my dear McGuffin, try that pork. It is homebred, homoft, and, I promise you, tender. Tell me if you think it is as good as yours? John, a glass of burgundy to Colonel McGuffin. You don't suppose there would be any unpleasant allusions to disagreeable home reports regarding McGuffin's manner of furnishing his larder? I say we all of us know ogres. We shake hands and dine with ogres. And if inconvenient moralists tell us we are cowards for our pains, we turn round with a tu quoque, or say that we don't meddle with other folks' affairs, that people are much less black than they are painted, and so on. What? Won't half the county go to Ogreham Castle? Won't some of the clergy say grace at dinner? Won't the mothers bring their daughters to dance with the young rawheads? And if Lady Ogreham happens to die, I won't say to go the way of all flesh, that is too revolting. I say, if Ogreham is a widower, do you aver, on your conscience and honor, that mothers will not be found to offer their young girls to supply the lamented lady's place? How stale this misanthropy is! Something must have disagreed with this cynic. Yes, my good woman. I dare say you would like to call another subject. Yes, my fine fellow, ogre at home, supple as a dancing master abroad, and shaking in thy pumps, and wearing a horrible grin of sham gaiety to conceal thy terror, lest I should point thee out. Thou art prosperous and honored, art thou? I say thou hast been a tyrant and a robber. Thou hast plundered the poor. Thou hast bullied the weak. Thou hast laid violent hands on the goods of the innocent and confiding. Thou hast made a prey of the meek and gentle who asked for thy protection. Thou hast been hard to thy kinsfolk and cruel to thy family. Go, monster! Ah, when shall little Jack come and drill daylight through thy wicked cannibal carcass? I see the ogre pass on, bowing right and left to the company, and he gives a dreadful sidelong glance of suspicion as he is talking to my Lord Bishop in the corner there. Ogres in our days need not be giants at all. In former times, and in children's books, where it is necessary to paint your moral in such large letters that there can be no mistake about it, ogres are made with that enormous mouth and rapier which you know of, and with which they can swallow down a baby, almost without using that great knife which they always carry. They are too cunning nowadays. They go about in society, slim, small, quietly dressed, and showing no especially great appetite. In my own young days there used to be play ogres, men who would devour a young fellow in one sitting, and leave him without a bit of flesh on his bones. They were quiet, gentlemanlike looking people. They got the young fellow into their cave. Champagne, pate de foie gras, and numberless good things were handed about, and then, having eaten, the young man was devoured in his turn. I believe these card and dice ogres have died away almost as entirely as hasty pudding giants whom Tom Thumb overcame. Now, there are ogres in city courts who lure you into their dens. About our Cornish mines I am told there are many most plausible ogres, who tempt you into their caverns and pick your bones there. In a certain newspaper there used to be lately a whole column of advertisements from ogres who would put on the most plausible, nay, piteous appearance, in order to inveigle their victims. You would read, a tradesman, established for 70 years in the city, and known, and much respected by Messrs. N. M. Rothschild and Baring Brothers, has pressing need for £3 until next Saturday. He can give security for £500,000, and £40,000 will be given for the use of the loan, and so on. Or, an influential body of capitalists are about to establish a company, of which the business will be enormous and the profits proportionately prodigious. They will require a secretary, of good address and appearance, at a salary of £2,000 per annum. He need not be able to write, but address and manners are absolutely necessary. As a mark of confidence in the company, he will have to deposit, and see, semicolon, or, a young widow of pleasing manners and appearance, who has a pressing necessity for £4.10 for 3 weeks, offers her heir's grand piano, valued at 300 guineas, a diamond cross of £800, and board and lodging in her elegant villa near Banbury Cross, with the best references and society, in return for the loan. I suspect these people are ogres. There are ogres and ogres. Polyphemus was a great, tall, one-eyed, notorious ogre, fetching his victims out of a hole, and gobbling them one after another. There could be no mistake about him. But so were the Siren's ogre's pretty blue-eyed things, peeping at you coaxingly from out of the water, and singing their melodious wheedles. And the bones round their caves were more numerous than the ribs, skulls, and thigh bones round the cavern of hulking Polypheme. To the castle gates of some of these monsters uprides the dapper champion of the pen, puffs boldly upon the horn which hangs by the chain, enters the hall resolutely, and challenges the big tyrant sulking within. We defy him to combat the enormous roaring ruffian. We give him a meeting on the green plain before his castle. Green? No wonder it should be green. It is manured with human bones. After a few graceful wheels and curvets, we take our ground. We stoop over our saddle. 'Tis but to kiss the locket of our lady love's hair. And now the visor is up. The lance is in rest.
Gillett's iron is the point for me.
A touch of the spur in the gallant sides of Pegasus, and we gallop at the great brute. Cut off his ugly head, Flibbertigibbet, my squire. And who are these who pour out of the castle? The imprisoned maidens, the maltreated widows, the poor old hoary grandfathers, who have been locked up in the dungeons these scores and scores of years, writhing under the tyranny of that ruffian. Aye, knights of the pen, may honor be your shield, and truth tip your lances. Be gentle to all gentle people. Be modest to women. Be tender to children. And as Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.